Okay, so let's just get started. So these are questions for the mantra. Here I've done from the suttas, how are funeral services done for the departed ones? And after that, is it necessary to keep the ashes, the tablets for the name of the departed in this world? Thank you. How are the funeral services done according to the suttas? It doesn't really say very much about these things in the suttas. I think the Buddhists probably just accepted the kind of standard ways, perhaps, that it was done at that time. And the only funeral that is described in the sutta is the funeral of the Buddha, and that is described in great detail. How they wrap the body, how they put it in the casket, they wrap it in cloth, and all of these kind of things. And of course, the Buddha was cremated, yeah, we know that. And then they build a stupa of the Buddha afterwards. That's one way of doing it, building a stupa. Yeah? If you are really worthy, if you have practiced really well, and all the BGF members are really proud of you because you're doing so well, maybe they will do the stupa for you when you pass away. That'd be very sweet, wouldn't it? In the early days, the stupas are very simple. In the early days, it was just a mound of earth. And then in later times, they become very elaborate structures with lots of bricks and all these kind of things. And these days, you travel around the world, you find some very large stupas in many places. And the largest ones are in Sri Lanka, they're absolutely enormous stupas. So also you find large stupas in places like Thailand and Burma, of course. Even India these days, you find these things. But generally speaking, cremation is considered the standard Buddhist way for funeral services. Of course, there is the really amazing funeral time of the Buddha. This is a really good stuff. And this is a funeral where you self-cremate your body. And this was some of them. These are stories not actually found in the sutras, but found in literature which comes soon after that. I think Venerable Ananda was one of the people who did this. According to the story, Venerable Ananda was very dear to so many people. There was two different groups of people who wanted his ashes. So because of that, he didn't want them to argue with each other and fight over the ashes. So what he did, he rose up in the air, spontaneously combusted ashes. And the ashes fell down, two piles on either side of the river. So each community had one pile each to kind of have his ashes or whatever. That is kind of going out in style. So as a Brahma always said, that the best way to die is in a plane crash. Plane explosion. Because when you are plane explosion, the plane explodes in mid air, bang! Instant cremation. No funeral. The funerals are very expensive these days. Are they here? Funerals expensive here in Malaysia? Also in Australia, it's ridiculously expensive. Just these coffins, fancy coffins, very, very expensive. So no expenses, Instant cremation in the air. And you also get insurance payout afterwards, So the family is very happy. And according to Adam Brown, you're close to heavenly realms, so it's easy to go to heaven afterwards. So this is the best kind of way to die, So people think it's bad to explode, and actually it's really good, isn't this? Really fast and efficient. So I'm not sure that's what you want to do here when you ask the question. Is it necessary to keep the ashes and tablets with names of the departed in this world? It's a nice thing to do. Because one of the things that we do in Buddhism is that we try to make some merit for the departed. And it's nice to kind of have that memory of the people there. So we kind of remember them every now and again. We go down to the monastery, we go somewhere else, do some act of charity in the name of the departed. And if they are around, they will feel that you're doing that for them. And make them very happy wherever they are. That will be a support for them in that world. So please keep the departed there, have the ashes. Not absolutely required, you can just remember them if you can. But sometimes it can be a nice thing to do. If you don't do it, it's okay. I'm certainly not going to blame you, so it's really up to you. That is kind of the ideal way. Okay. Pirata, please explain four levels of stream entry and the fetters eradicated at each level of attainment. Thank you, good Metta. Okay, four levels of stream entry. Okay, there's four levels. As you there's four levels of awakening and reading. The first level is dream and dream. And the second one is called Sakadagami, once returned, and Anagami, not returned, and Arahant, which means like the worthy one, the fully enlightened being. So, and each of these levels, as you rightly point out, you abandon certain fetters. Remember, fetter is like a tie, like a rope that ties you to samsara. As you abandon these fetters, you are loosening the grip of samsara, but eventually you are out of it altogether. So the idea is that this is a gradual process. With the Buddha, it seemed like it happened all in one go. Maybe because of the power of the Buddha, so bang, it was all gone. But most people, it's usual to go through these stages gradually. And stream entry is in many ways the most important one, apart from Arahant chamber. Stream entry is very important. And that is the time when you see the Dhamma for the first time. You have a vision of the Dhamma. Now, from now on, you know what the Buddha's teachings are. And from now on, you have no choice anymore. You have to practice the noble mental path. Even if you don't want to, even if you, not sure if you want to go to Nibbana, at that point, no choice. So you've got to decide that before you become a stream member, but it's too late. I'm just joking, Because if when you see the Dhamma, you know what it is? Wow, it's so good. Of course, you're happy to practice. You would never even dream of not wanting to go that way. This is so wonderful. Please don't. When I speak, take some of it with a pinch of salt, otherwise you're going to come back to a strange idea sometimes. This is the problem with Adam Ram. I've been with Adam Ram for 23 years. I'm never sure whether he's joking or whether he's serious. It's so hard to know sometimes. Is it a joke or is it meant seriously? And I think it's probably more than a bit of both. It's really, really, it's very interesting. He's kind of this unfathomable person. It's very hard to fathom Adam Ram. That's kind of why I like him so much as well. When you become a screen mentor, you have seen the Dhamma. This is really the most important part of being a screen mentor. And you may wonder, so what then is the difference between the screen mentor and the Arahant? And the difference is just that seeing the Dhamma is one thing. It's like a vision, but it hasn't penetrated all the way to the depth of your psyche yet. It takes time for all your thinking and all your perceptions to align with that view. That is the difference between Arahant and stream entry, and the time it takes to align that view. Your entire psyche aligns up with the view that you have. But in terms of view, there is no difference in view between the stream entry and the Arahant. The stream entry has just as much insight and understanding of the Dhamma as the Arahant has. People sometimes often don't understand that. So the stream entry has let go of three fetters. One of them is the attachment to rule, to precepts and vows. Sila, Bhatta, Paramasa is one of them. So you don't have any, grasp onto these things anymore. You have given up all doubt, which is great. Now you have full idea. That's what I mean by seeing the Dhamma, because you see the Dhamma for yourself. You know exactly what in this world, what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. You know exactly what the teachings are and what the teachings are not. So no doubt anymore. And you have given up the self view, the atta-nitya, atta-nitya. No self view anymore. You know that this is a process, five khandhas going on. There's nothing inherently in there which is you. This is the real me. It's all gone. So it's kind of nice. In the meantime, remember, these are the factors of what it means to be a stream member. Don't try to replicate that in your own practice. I heard some people say, it's the stream member, no sila bhakta paramasa, no attachment to precepts and vows. It means that if we want to be stream member, we shouldn't attach either. So not attaching to rule means, okay, precepts not attached to them. So when you go out into the city, somebody asks you to take a drink. No worries, Just drink because of no attachment, right? That is the wrong way of thinking. It is mixing up the path with the result of the path. The result of the path is that you don't attach. Because when you are a stream mentor, it is all internalized. Virtue is natural for the stream mentor, That's why they don't need to attach. There's no sila bhakta paramasa. For the rest of us, please attach a little bit to your virtue, to your kindness. If you don't attach a little bit to kindness, you're going to fail a little bit. That's part of the problem. Then, you become a Sakadagami later on. Sakadagami means once returning, What are we returning to? What is returning once to the sensual world? We can be anywhere in the Devalokas or wherever it is in the sensual world. The difference between Sakadagami and Sotapanna is that Sakadagami has also abandoned a little bit of the greed, hatred and delusion. Yeah? So you have less greed, hatred and delusion than you had before. Anagami. Anagami means you would be reborn and non-returner. You go to the Brahmaloka, and from the Brahmaloka, you go out of existence from there. Yeah? Parinibbana from there. Brahmaloka, no more anger, no more sense desire, yeah? No more ill will, no more sense, completely gone. Not a smidgen left. And this is why it is quite easy for the anagamis to attain samadhi, jhanas. So you just hang out with anagami, you attain jhanas all the time, because the two main hindrances, or the five hindrances, are sense desire and ill will. These are the two big obstacles. Get rid of that, then it's easy to attain samadhi as a consequence. And then you have the arahant. Arahant, let's go also of the five higher fetters. We call them the five lower fetters and the five higher fetters. These are the so the five lower fetters are the five I just mentioned now, two of the anagami and three of the spear mantra. And the five higher fetters are basically restlessness, ignorance, delusion, conceit. You have no more conceit, you don't compare yourself to anyone else anymore. Anagami is a slight remnant of conceit, and all attachment, even to the higher jhana realms, is gone. Dhana realms and the Arupa realms, that's fine for you. These five high factors aren't really talked about very much in the sutta. They're not the important ones. The important ones are the five lower factors, and they are the ones that really matter here. So if you're an anagami, you're already doing pretty well. Okay, so good. These are things to look forward to on the path. Okay, question number one. As for rebirth, does this mean that always a fixed number of beings going up and down in the six spheres of samsara? For example, 1 zillion beings in six planes go up and down. I don't get it how this can be related to non-self. And consciousness seems like a device to carry on the next life, doesn't it? Thank you. So how this can be related to non-self is just like, if you imagine your life right now, your life right now, you have maybe, depending on how old you are, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, compared to what you are now, 10 years ago, are you the same person or are you a different person from that? And the answer is, neither exactly the same, nor entirely different. Yeah, there's a difference and continuity going on at the same time. And this is what it means to be a human being. They're happy, but carry on. But there's also differences. Things are always changing. Our bodies are certainly changing. But our psychology is also changing over time. So there's continuity and difference not coming together. And this is really what this is all about. And that is exactly the same in this life as it is when you go from one life to the next one. The mind, this is why I'm talking about the mind. The mind is very habitual. This is how we can recognize ourselves in the past life. Because so many of our habits, so much of the things we did in the past, carry on from the past life to the next life. Yeah? And this is how there is continuity and change. So this is the thing. And that continuity has nothing to do with the self. It's just that it's a relative continuity. It's a continuity of habits, a continuity of certain traits. Eventually those habitual things also, they also change, but they change more slowly. So there's a sense of continuity, but also change within that continuity as well. So this is what is going on here. And this is kind of this complex set of phenomena working together. Continuity and change, but not absolute continuity. Just as it is in this life, so it is between lives as well. So if you understand this life correctly, you also understand how things go from one life to the next one. And you're right, it is kind of going up and down in these realms, as it would have done. 1 zillion beings, are you sure it's exactly 1 zillion beings? I know you've counted them, there's a lot, so I guess zillion is kind of a And it's a pretty flexible term, as you know, so not kind of too precise, I suppose. So you've got your kind of your take on that one. Consciousness seems like a device to carry on. Consciousness is not a device, this is kind of the thing, yeah? Consciousness, when you say it is a device, then you are saying almost like it is a permanent entity. It is something, when you say it's a device. But consciousness itself is a changing entity. Yeah? Consciousness is it's always moving from one sense to another one, back and forth. And because of that, there's nothing permanent within consciousness itself. So this is kind of the point here. The way to think about this, which I think is very useful, think about the river. You think your river flowing, and if you look at the river, if you look at the water, the shape, the overall shape of the river is roughly the same all the time, yeah? If you look at the shape, it's roughly the same width. Some places the river kind of bulges up a little bit, some places it goes a bit wide, yeah? The river has a certain shape to it. But if you look at the actual water molecules, they are changing all the time, very, very fast. There's nothing in that river which is the same one moment after the other one. The overall shape is the same, but the actual content of the river is continuously changing. There's no essence, there's nothing that goes through it, which is always there. And human beings are a bit like that. There's no essence here, nothing which goes from one moment to the next one. But the overall shape of who we are is roughly the same. It was scary if I was sitting and suddenly I turned into an elephant or something, yeah? Because the shape isn't kind of constant. That would be kind of weird. Because the shape has a continuity to it. Our mind has a continuity to it without there being an inherent essence to it. So that's why in the suttas, they always talk about the stream of consciousness. Yeah? Consciousness is a stream that flows in this way. It is not an entity. And it flows from one life into the next one. And this is what recollection of past life is all about. The stream of consciousness flowing through. Nothing persisting through that. I hope that is clearly helpful. Question number two. I accidentally swear sometimes when I get shocked or surprised. I don't mean anything. Does this create karma or a bad image to our religion as a Buddhist in Malaysia? Oh, that's very bad for Buddhism, isn't it, if you swear. Is it bad image? Well, I think it depends on how you swear. I mean, swearing is becoming more and more common in our society. I don't know if you've been to Australia, people swear left, right, and centre, yeah? It's so common, and sometimes quite coarsely. And then you see it on TV as well, if you watch programs that are made in kind of the UK or the US, or whatever, swearing seems to be very common these days. So it depends on how you use it. If you use it to curse somebody else, if you're angry with somebody, if you tell them to whatever it wants, yeah? Get lost or whatever, you're angry. If you do that, then of course it's bad, yeah? Because you're coming from anger. And because it's bad, it's going to be bad karma. Yeah? But if you swear, more like, sometimes people swear just to kind of underline something, yeah? They use these words kind of as adjectives to kind of make a strong statement. If you do it only for that, you make a strong statement. Then, depending on the situation, depending on the people around you, it may not necessarily be bad karma. But in a society, Malaysia, maybe quite a conservative society, yeah? I don't know. Is it acceptable to go around swearing a lot in Malaysia? Or is it kind of considered a bit dodgy? So consider the circumstance, consider the situation you are in, who you are with, the company. And if you think that it's going to be a bad image to Buddhism or whatever, then please don't do so. Because, most countries, Buddhists are in minorities, yeah? And if we don't behave properly, it causes problems for other Buddhists as well. So look at your intention. What decides karma is your intention, not your action, your intention. Why are you doing it? That is what decides karma in this world. So, but sometimes people, it's considered cool to swear a little bit, yeah? So if you want to be cool, then sometimes you have to, you want to be cool. Anyways, I hope that helps a little bit. Dear Ajahn, Buddha talked about rebirth and not reincarnation. And I'll please explain the difference between the two terms. Thank you. It just depends on what we mean by these terms, yeah? There isn't really an inherent difference between rebirth and reincarnation. They can both be used in the same way, they can be used in different ways. But the English word reincarnation, it comes from the word karma. Karma is Latin word which means flesh, Yeah? So in the karma means in the flesh, re-karma means again in the flesh. So the idea there is that the soul moves from one life to another one life, and it goes from one body to the next one. So that's why reincarnation is often understood to have this idea of soul moving from one life to the next one. And the idea of the soul is a bit like a permanent entity. And this is often used in Hinduism, and of course in Hinduism there is an atta, there is a self, yeah? The self goes from one life to the next one. And this is how it, why it can be problematic to use the term reincarnation. The idea of rebirth is nothing really, doesn't have any implications about the soul, or at least not in Buddhism, it doesn't have that. So that's why rebirth is more appropriate sometimes. Because it just means a process, yeah? Process going from one up to the next one. No soul going across, no atta going across, nothing inherent going across, no essence going across, no personal essence. Maybe a nice way to translate atta. No personal essence going across. Okay, here we go. Do you think aspiring to attain stream membership is too far-fetched? Is it doable for a layperson? It is doable. It's possible. I must admit, I don't know of that many lay stream anchors. I don't know. Anyone? It's hard to know, yeah, because people don't go with kind of big kind of signs on the same stream anchor or anything like that. But it's true, at the time of the Buddha, there were lay people who were stream anchors. So it's possible, yeah. So don't discount the possibility, because if you discount the possibility, you may be putting a blockage in your path. But should you aim for it? I think it is not a good idea to aim for these things, because they can just be a source of craving, a source of frustration, a source of agitation, a source of restlessness, a source of disappointment, because you can't get there. So don't aim for these things. Much better, rather than aiming for results, much better in Buddhism to focus on the causes, the things that get you there, yeah? And then the results will come in the natural course, of course, as you put in the causes. So just remember the cause, that's what matters. Because we don't know what kind of faculties we have, what kind of abilities we have. We don't know how far down the path we have to go before we get there. And often it's a recipe for disaster if we aspire for this thing. Don't aspire for samadhi. Don't aspire for anything. Just in your life, just be kind. Just be friendly. Moment to moment, day after day, all the time, do these things. Do a little bit of meditation to support you in your kindness. And as you do that, you put it in the causes. Listen to the Dhamma. As you do that, things will take their own course and the results will come. Yeah? And sometimes they come out of the blue. Wow, what a wonderful thing, yeah? Some of you feel just happy in the daily life. You feel a sense of joy. Why? Because you're putting in the causes. You never ask for it, it just happens. Be very careful, because once you start to get some results, that is where often people go wrong. Because once you get some results, you start to attach to those, and you want them again. So one of the tricks of meditation practice is actually having the ability to get the results every now and again without attaching to it, without aspiring too high to get them again. It's one of the kind of subtle tricks of meditation. So yes, know that it's possible to become a stream entry. Don't aspire to it. Just allow it to happen in due course. Put in the courses and you will guarantee that you will get there. Remember that one of the ways to always judge your progress on the path is always just to look at your progress from 1 year to the next one, or 6 months to 6 months, and see if there is an improvement in your qualities. Are you becoming more kind? Are you becoming more soft and gentle? Are you having less ill will and desires? This is how the Buddha said we should judge ourselves. Yeah? This is not just, I'm not just making this up. This is not just random stuff coming out of my mouth. This is a it's a real Buddhist teaching, so this is what the Buddha said we should be doing here. So do take kind of stock of yourself every now and again. Every time you come on a retreat or whatever, ask yourself if your mindfulness is better, your samadhi is better, your gentleness is better. And if it is, then well done, you're on the path. Eventually you have to become a stream anchor, whether you want to or not. And I guarantee you that you want to, if you understand what it means. It's a positive thing. And then you're on the right track. Thank you. How can I help my pet dog to take rebirth in the higher realm? that's a good thought. Yes, a kind thought, because you want to be kind to your dog. So congratulations on being kind to your dog. Please, not everyone is kind to the dogs in this world, but that's already a good starting point already. So the best way is just to be continue that kindness. Yeah. You can't really explain the Dhamma to your dog. Yeah, just face it. This dog, this is dependent origination. Yeah, if you can understand it. Don't try that, because too, the dog is going to be very confused, and that's not even really confused, it's going to... But if you are kind to the dog, remember, kindness means the dog feels more relaxed, it feels at ease, it feels kind of happy in your presence, and that is the kind of mind state that is most likely to allow the dog a good rebirth. If you are harsh with your dog, if you discipline it a little bit too much, then the dog is not going to have that happiness, and it's more likely not to go to a good destination afterwards. So really, just kindness, yeah, is often the best way to treat our pets, like everyone else. Okay. Somebody told me about it, they had a pet, and they had heard chanting its whole life, yeah, because he lived in a Buddhist household, and whenever he heard chanting, he was so happy about his pet. He loved to hear chanting. Yeah. So if you have that kind of pet, you can put on a bit of chanting when the dog is coming close to his death, yeah, and then kind of calm it down, especially for that. Yeah. Just one possibility. Do you think that the Buddha still suffered in the slightest way after awakening? Yeah? Like when the Sangha separated in Kosambi, and no one listened to him and other events. The Buddha, when you have a physical body, you have no choice, but you have to suffer sometimes. Because a physical body, it is inherently painful. Yeah? If you kind of go out, it hurts. And it doesn't matter whether you are the Buddha, you're still going to keep that painful feeling. Yeah? So there still has to be a suffering, even if you are the Buddha, even if you are an Arahant. But the distinction is, the Buddha makes a distinction between two kinds of dharmas, the physical dharma and the mental dharma. And the dharma that has been pulled out by the Arahant and the Buddha is the mental dharma. Yeah, so when the Buddha, when the monks in Kosambi, when they argue, the Buddha doesn't get depressed or sad because the monks are arguing. Yeah, he's probably not very happy with it. He probably doesn't feel any joy because of that. But also, he doesn't actually suffer because of that. Yeah, it's not going to hinder his meditation. When he goes out upward and sits under the tree to meditate, he's going to get into jhana straight away, regardless of that, because the Buddha is always able to access those states. So in that sense, he doesn't really suffer. But the physical suffering can still be there. But it is interesting, because even though he doesn't suffer, you know, he obviously, there are certain things that he delights in, other things that he doesn't delight in. And the quarrel at Kosambi would have been something he did not delight in. Maybe he felt a little bit, not sad, but maybe kind of felt like, you know, a bit uninspired perhaps. Yeah, I'm not sure if I want to teach those monks anymore, they're not really doing the right thing anyway. Actually, he probably never thought that either, because it's too wise to think like that. But obviously, he would have maybe lost some inspiration. Maybe that's why he left, yeah, that's why he walked away then. Also, there's a nice sutta somewhere where the Buddha says, this is after Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahamoggallana, they have attained Parinibbana. They were Arahants, they are gone. And the Buddha says in the sutta, the Sangha feels empty now when Venerable Sariputta and Mahamoggallana have disappeared. And it's also quite strange. The Buddha feels the sense of, almost like a sense of loss, almost. You know, obviously, it doesn't feel sadness, but there's some sense that the Sangha isn't the same anymore after the two main supporters or two main disciples have disappeared. So there is a kind of slightly ambivalent there. The Buddha doesn't feel pain, mental pain, but obviously, he is able to delight more or delight less, depending on the situation. It's a good question, and it's a hard one to answer. I must admit, I'm not, it's a slightly tricky one. But anyway, that's all I can say on that one. Yamasa, what is the difference between karma and merit? I came across a chart that indicates that meditation earns more merit than, say, dana. Can a as I'm trying to clarify on the above. So these are just different words written here. And karma and merit are essentially the same thing. Merit tends to become a slightly lower type of karma, and karma can often become a higher. So merit was often is the word punya in Pali, boon in Pali, punya in Pali. And the word basically refers to three kinds of punya in Sutta. The punya which comes from generosity, from virtue, and from meditation. Yeah? Three types. And it's very, very closely related to karma. Good karma and punya are, I would think it's fair to say, they actually are synonymous. They are the same thing. Yeah? So if you make good merit, you're always on the right track. You're making good karma at the same time. Meditation earns more merit than, say, dharma. It can do, yeah, it depends how you meditate. So if you meditate like this, yeah, it doesn't earn very much merit at all. Much better doing dharma, yeah, or being kind to someone. It depends on your mind state, yeah. And this is one of the things that Buddha says, if you are going to meditate, the real meditation is the meditation where the five hindrances are gone. Yeah. That is the meditation praised by the Buddha. The meditation where there are hindrances of the mind is not praised by the Buddha. Yeah? So that is really the ideal that we're trying to strive for. There. So in that particular sutta, this is actually the Vilama Sutta, found in the group of 9, number 20, that talks about this. And it's a slight, that sutta is maybe, I don't really know if it is the Buddha actually taught quite like that, because it has this very kind of structured, you know, the amount of merit you get, it doesn't sound to me like the Buddha. It sounds a bit like some accountant that accounting for the merit, amount of merit that we can have. But according to that sutta, it talks about different levels of dana, yeah? And some of the highest dana, according to that sutta, is if you give a lodging to the Sangha. Because if you give a lodging to the Sangha, it means that you are allowing the Sangha of the present and the future, long way into the future, a kuti or a hut for the Sangha can maybe last a few centuries, yeah? If you go to Sri Lanka today, you find an ancient cave that has been sitting there for 2,000 years, and has been used by monks for 2,000 years in Sri Lanka. It's one of the great things about Sri Lanka, it's a very ancient Buddhist culture. It's kind of quite nice to go there and see some of that ancient Buddhist culture. So this is kind of the highest kind of merit. If you give a gift of lodging to the whole Sangha, ideally headed by the Buddha. And by the way, if you give to the Sangha of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, male and female, that is even higher merit than giving to only one Sangha. Yeah, so keep that in mind as well. That's an interesting, important point. But then the sutta goes on and says, what is higher merit than that? And higher merit than that is to go, it says there, to take the triple refuge. Yeah? Higher than that is to keep the five precepts. Higher than that is to have a mind of metta. Mind of metta is basically meditation, yeah? Metta to the whole world. And higher than that is to have insight into impermanence. But remember that when you go up this ladder, it doesn't mean that you stop doing the stuff before. Yeah? It doesn't mean that you meditate now, I'm finished with dharma, I'm just done, yeah? I'm kind of graduated to the higher level. It doesn't work like that. You take the previous steps with you as you go up. The higher you are on the ladder, the more generous you are. Street members are incredibly generous. I just watch Ajahn Brahm. He just gives all the time. Yeah, it's just amazing how much giving he does. His whole life is basically about giving. Yeah? And it's very beautiful. And it's very nice to see that. And the same is true of any great person. Very generous. This is one of the ways that you can actually gauge someone's spiritual maturity by how generous they are, how giving they are all the time, basically. So remember, you take these things with you. According to this, when you take the triple refuge, it's more merit than dharma. But remember, it depends how you take the triple refuge, yeah? You take it with a heart of faith. You take it with a powerful sense of confidence. That is when it is very powerful. See how these things affect your mind. When you bow down to the Buddha afterwards, what do you feel? And very often when we bow down, we don't feel very much. We just bow because we're supposed to bow, yeah? It's not, in that case, not very much merit. But if you give an act of generosity and you really feel happy about that, then that is merit because of the happiness you get with it.
When he came to five precepts, okay, that's a little bit different because it's kind of more long term. But that's true. That certainly does have obviously a lot of merit to it. He's doing something very positive. That's great. When it comes to metta, remember, when the Buddha talks about metta, he talks about very high states of metta, not just kind of sitting there saying, oh yeah, we're all being happy, well, yeah. It's more that the heart has to come into it. It has to be powerful. Then it starts to work. Okay. Leonardo, would you consider always one thing, some to be good as craving? Would you consider always one thing, something to be good as craving? So you mean one thing is the same as craving? That's what you're asking here. Is one thing the same as craving? Essentially, it is the same, yeah, if you want a lot, but the craving is often very narrowly defined. Yeah? So craving is often defined in the sutras, tanha, the craving for sensual pleasure, the craving for existence, the craving for annihilation. But one thing is often can be broader than that. So you can want to be kind. Yeah? Wanting to be kind is a great thing. Yeah? That is a good kind of desire. So please cultivate that desire of wanting to be kind, of wanting to meditate, of wanting to be wise, wanting to kind of move towards awakening. All of these things are good. Very often wanting and craving are synonymous. They are basically just two sides of the same thing. I'm not sure if that's what you're asking, but I don't quite understand. So hopefully I've asked your question. If not, then try again later on, let's see what happens. So. And then, why does the Thai tradition refuse to ordain nuns? the reason is historical, yeah? Nuns here mean bhikkhunis, that's what it means. They're kind of like bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. So. Why don't they do that in Thailand? And the answer is that it's actually a law in Thailand. I think that monks are not allowed to ordain bhikkhunis. It's a law that was written in 1929 or something. Yeah. Reason is, you know, Thailand has a very strong ancient Buddhist tradition. And because of that, it's also very, very hierarchical. Yeah? It's a very big hierarchy. And sometimes modeled on the Christian church. You have the Sangha Raja on top, yeah? And you have the Somdets, yeah? the Mahathera Samakam, which is all the Somdets coming together making decisions about Buddhism. And you have under there all the Chakuns and Prakrus, and you have district heads, and you have this and that. It's a very, very hierarchical structure. So. And these hierarchical structures tend to be very conservative. With this hierarchical structure. So this hierarchical structure, once they have decided that there's not going to be any big need, and they decided this about 100 years ago or something, then it takes a long, long time for them to change their mind. And this is why there had been opposition in Thailand towards bhikkhuni ordination. Lots of monks in Thailand are actually supportive of this. You know, the ordinary monks, you know, around the countryside, often very educated monks as well. I know some monks in Thailand. There's one quite well-known Thai monk called the Prakukrit, and he leads a large kind of a Buddha Vajra movement, which basically is all about going back to the Buddha. And I've spoken to him a few times, and he's basically very open about bhikkhuni ordination. Yeah. Some of the monks over there are actually very open, and very often it's the hierarchy forces them to be against it. But actually, if they had a choice, I think many of them would be very supportive of this. But what is more important, I think, than what the hierarchy says, because the hierarchy is always conservative. And the hierarchy, when they see that there is enough change on the ground, the hierarchy will often become kind of, you know, be dragged after everyone else. What is happening in Thailand? There's a lot of bhikkhunis in Thailand now. I was in Thailand in January, and I was invited to go over there to teach in there to the bhikkhunis. I went to a monastery in Uthai Thani, which is Uttarakhand, halfway between Bangkok and Chiang Mai, quite close to the Burmese border. And there were 60 women coming together, over half of them Bhikkhunis. They said it was the largest gathering of Bhikkhunis ever in Thailand, and they came to listen to Bhikkhunis from India. It was very, very nice. I felt very honored, very privileged to be able to do that. And they all came together, a very simple monastery there. And they told me that there's over 200 Bhikkhunis now in Thailand, living in many different places, many different monasteries. Some of them are very large, like Wat Song Dhamma Kalyani. Wat Song Dhamma Kalyani is from another country. Sangha Dhamma Kalyani. This is the Aya Dhammananda's monastery outside of Bangkok. Okay, it's quite a large place, lots of Bhikkhunis, lots of seminaries. There's a couple of large monasteries in Chiang Mai. Nirodharam is one of them, which is run by a very, very well-respected Bhikkhuni, who had some very good meditation before she became a Bhikkhuni. Yeah, it's very well supported. If you go there, it's a beautiful monastery, very beautiful. Buildings are very modern and new, and they obviously have very strong financial support. So it's good to see that the Bhikkhunis too are getting some good financial support, yeah? If you go to the Dhammasara monastery in Perth, also well supported, yeah? Because they have a Ajahn to kind of support, help them out. That's also very, very good. That's a good place to be, yeah? So in Thailand, it's all happening in Thailand, yeah? It's happening from the bottom up, the grassroots are kind of there. Lay people are very supportive of Bhikkhunis in general, yeah? Many monks are very supportive of Bhikkhunis, although sometimes they have to be quiet because the hierarchy forces them to be quiet. So it's all happening, and there's no turning back to this. There's no way that the Bhikkhunis are going to disappear from Thailand. It's already going. And eventually, the hierarchy is going to have to turn around and also to accept the Bhikkhuni ordination. There's no, you know, you can see how it's growing so fast now everywhere. Sri Lanka growing even faster. 3,000 Bhikkhunis that I say there is in Sri Lanka. So it's really well established in the Theravada tradition there. So it's interesting because Ajahn Brahm is very famous or infamous for his Bhikkhuni ordination in Perth, yeah? But Ajahn Brahm is actually very well connected in the Thai Sangha hierarchy, yeah? He has met the Thai Sangha Raja, has been a new one. He knows many other people very, very high up in the hierarchy. They know exactly what he has done, yeah? They don't tell him off, but they are his friends. So you can see that there is already some very positive things happening in the hierarchy there. And just given enough time, these things are going to change. It's just the conservative nature of our society. Societies are always conservative. It takes time for these things to change. Eventually, it will happen in China like everywhere else. Just be patient. Just do the right thing. Continue to support the Bhikkhunis. This is the most important thing. If we continue supporting them, they will grow. Change will happen all by itself. Just do the right thing. Don't demand too much, and then it will happen. Okay, dear Aja, what is your thoughts on neutering dogs or cats? Is there any sutta on this? That's the danger. If you say there's a sutta on everything, people take it literally. Then they want to know. Okay, what about space shuttles? Is there anything about space shuttles in the sutta? Neutering dogs or cats? Nothing. I don't think there's anything in the sutras about that. I'm not sure if it. Did they do that at the time of the Buddha? I'm not sure if there is any reference to that in the canon. Is it right thing to do? I mean, generally speaking, it's not nice to kind of cut, tamper with other life. Yeah, if somebody comes to us and kind of cuts all parts of our body, we don't want to be too happy with it usually. Yeah. But sometimes it's necessary, yeah? It's necessary for the greater good of society. And I think it's a relatively small thing when it comes to animals. It's not the main thing. It causes too many problems if we don't do it. So I don't think there's a main problem there. As long as you do it with a sense of compassion and kindness, and you don't do it out of anger or ill will or whatever it is, I don't think it's a major issue. I don't think you would call it. What kind of karma is that? It's kind of great karma. And remember, too often we talk about karma. People come to me, is this good or is it bad? Is it good karma or bad karma? It's not as simple as that. It's not as if everything is either good or bad. It's not just in between. Yeah, it's grey. Because our intentions are kind of mixed. Yeah. And so this kind of thing here, you neuter a dog or a cat, is it good or bad karma? If you do it with anger, it's bad karma. If you do it with compassion because you understand the broader consequences, it's probably kind of neutral. It's not a good or bad.
Hiranta, is it possible to love without attachment? I find this hard, especially towards family, spouse, my wonderful pets, etc. Thank you. Yes, it is difficult, yeah, especially with family, and I of course I know exactly what you mean, and that's one of the reasons when you do metta meditation, I recommend you not to start with your family. Because if you start with your family, it's more about attachment than love, yeah? And this is kind of part of the problem. But if you are able to have metta towards the directions, yeah, like the north, the south, and all the people who are there, it's going to be much more a pure form of metta because of that. Because you're not going to have attachment to the north, yeah? That's kind of part of I don't think you can have attachment to the northern direction. So it's just going to be a kind of a metta. So do things that don't cause attachment in your meditation, the metta meditation, because that line between love and attachment, sometimes it can be hard to see, and you can easily kind of go too far one way or the other way. So just all beings, the nice thing about all beings is annoying. Also, they become genderless. You don't have to worry about gender anymore. Are they male or female? It's just all beings. A being is a being, yeah? That's also quite nice about it. So is it possible to love without attachment? It is possible, because it is possible to sit down in your meditation and just radiate kindness to the whole world. That's love without attachment. In your family life, you strive towards that. It's going to take, it's difficult to get there, but you move gradually towards it. You lower your attachments gradually, and you practice your metta to the whole world gradually. And slowly these things move a little bit more into balance. Don't expect to overcome your attachments completely to family members. It's almost impossible. Yeah? It is very, very profound. And even if you become a stream mentor, you may still have a bit of attachment left. Remember the Venerable Ananda, he cried when the Buddha passed away. Yeah. So even he had some attachment to the Buddha. He was a stream mentor. There's a lovely little sutta in the Kanda Samyutta, I guess, Sangyutta Nikaya, about Makula Pita, Makula Mata. They're both supposed to have been stream mentors, yeah. And then they go to the Buddha and they say, well, we have such a wonderful marriage, yeah. We have all stream mentors, yeah, we have a really wonderful marriage. We want to be reborn together in the future life and continue to be husband and wife in the next life. What do we have to do that? So obviously even they would have had a little bit of attachment, yeah? Even though they were stream mentors. And what did the Buddha say if you want to be reborn together in the future life? What he said is, practice the same kind of spiritual qualities, same dharma, same sila, same learning, same wisdom and this kind of thing. Then there's a chance that we'll get reborn again in the future life. And maybe some couples, they would like to ask, how can we make sure we don't get reborn together? It depends, yeah, if there is a little bit. So anyway, so that's how you do that. Dear Ajahn, please give some pointers, simple instructions on morning meditation, 15 minutes to get the day started, and evening night meditation, 15 minutes to relax, sleep after a day of work and household chores. Thank you. Okay, so morning meditation I think is great. Remember, the most important thing about meditation practice, do it at the time that is suitable for you and when it's easy for you to do. Yeah? So whenever it feels good, when it feels natural. Personally, I find the morning meditation often quite nice, because in the morning, the mind is quite fresh, you can feel there's more energy there. I don't know if you noticed here, we did meditation in the morning and in the afternoon. In the morning, I always feel quite sharp in meditation. In the afternoon, it takes much longer for me to get any kind of meditation at all. That's why I prefer to do the metta at that time, so I don't risk falling asleep and embarrass myself in front of all of you. Yeah? If I'm going to sleep, or very embarrassing for me. So I do something more active to avoid that. So do whatever works. And 15 minutes is great. Yeah, if you can do 15 minutes, that's wonderful. Don't set the bar too high, because then it will be impossible. And as I was saying before, to help you out, one of the hardest things when you are by yourself is to get into the meditation mood. Yeah? The mood is so hard to get. Because when you are with a group of people like here, we're all kind of helping ourselves a little bit. Yeah? Everybody's quiet. Sometimes the peace is very beautiful in here when we're doing meditation together. You don't get that in the same way at home. So to create that atmosphere at home, very often useful to have a guided meditation. To have a guided meditation, somebody's voice you like, yeah? Somebody's voice that makes you feel right. Somebody's guiding that you kind of believe in, have confidence in that. And listen to that, and allow that to help you get into the right kind of mind frame. When you do that, will be very helpful. What kind of meditation you should do, I cannot tell you that. It really depends on you, yeah? I always like to do the meditations the Buddha recommended the most, which is mindfulness of breathing. If you do only 15 minutes, often it is enough. Just you can do a little bit of metta, perhaps, and just a little bit of relaxation, just enjoying the peace of the present moment. If you are just able to allow your mind to emerge into the present moment and do a little bit of metta, already you're doing really well there. It's hard to do a breath meditation if you're doing 15 minutes. There really isn't enough time, I think, to really get into the breath, I would say. But again, it's up to you. Whatever works for you is fine. In the evening, again, and the Buddha always recommended metta before we go to sleep. So I would definitely do metta in the evening. I would not certainly not recommend anapanasati breath meditation because it can make you too awake, too bright. Metta can be just right at that time. But again, don't think it too far because then you will become too bright again in the evening as well. So, see what happens. Okay, Vimajan, is it just a different term or concept? Soul, consciousness, alaya, vijnana, pukkala. Thank you, Anja. Are these the different terms and concepts? No, these are not just different terms, these are different concepts as well. Yeah? These are completely different ideas. They have a different meaning. So, first of all, what we are doing here, you're using Pali words or even Sanskrit words and then English words, yeah? So, because they come from different languages, it can be hard to compare sometimes because idea in different languages can often not overlap very well. It can be hard to have a proper comparison. But usually in English, soul is a permanent entity inside of me, which is the real me, yeah? That's the soul. It doesn't exist. There is no such permanent entity. It's a fantasy. Made up because it feels like we have permanently the same delusion that human beings have in Buddhism, they have everywhere. Yeah? Everywhere you have that delusion of the self, and that is where the idea of soul comes from. It comes from the delusion of the self. So we create this idea of a soul that does not actually refer to any existing reality whatsoever. Consciousness, on the other hand, does refer to an existing reality because consciousness is just the ability to be aware. If you weren't conscious, you would be unconscious. No, if you were conscious, you wouldn't be able to experience anything. Yeah? Consciousness is what allows experience to happen. Without consciousness, there can be no experience. The consciousness is not the soul. Consciousness is changing all the time. Alaya vijnana, this is one of those things, that one of those terms that was coined by later Buddhism, a long time after the Buddha passed away. And it was used then to explain, this is called the storehouse consciousness in English, and it was used to explain karma, because people had a really hard time explaining karma. How can karma possibly work? Yeah, you do something in the past life, but it has resolved in the next life. How is that possible then? Yeah, the only possible way is it is stored somewhere. Because it is stored somewhere, it can have a result later on. And this is how they come up with this idea of alaya vijnana. And these concepts are, if you read about Buddhist philosophy, I don't know much about Buddhist philosophy myself, because I'm not that interested. But I think if you read about it, these are the concepts that I criticize heavily by Buddhist philosophers, because it's almost like sneaking in a sense of permanence into Buddhism. Yeah? Alaya vijnana, storehouse consciousness. Well, what is it?
Is it some kind of permanent consciousness which stores things? What does it actually refer to? What does it mean? And it's a very good question. And it's almost like sneaking in a sense of self or a real self through the back door. Alla Vinyana, in the Theravada group, we have the Sambhava Dhamma. Sambhava Dhamma. Sambhava means the own nature things, things that have their own nature, yeah? Very big in the Pali commentaries. And this also is a little bit like sneaking a cell in the back door. So that was heavily criticized by other Buddhists. They were not Theravada. You Theravada, you believe in the cell. What is all the Sambhava stuff? Then the Theravadas replied back, and we have all these arguments, yeah? And this is why nobody gets any good meditation, because then there was some arguing instead. This is part of the problems. We were talking about universities before. This is part of the problem with universities. You end up arguing, you do academic stuff, rather than really coming to grips with the real practice. So that's Alaya Vinyana, it's a kind of quasi-soul, yeah? A kind of soul, but not really a soul. Pudgala, pugala just means person. Pudgala is a Sanskrit word for person. And the pugala in the Pali Suttas just means that. It just means, you know, this is the pugala. Pugala's people everywhere. And so that doesn't have doesn't say anything about the self. It just means five aggregates coming together in this particular way. We call it a person. If the five aggregates come together in a different way, we call it a dog, yeah? A different way, we call it a deva, or whatever. So just the particular way that the five aggregates come together. But in later Buddhist philosophy, there was a school called the Pugalavada. And the Pugalavada had the doctrine, the Pugala doctrine. And they were saying that behind, there is a person kind of behind the five aggregates, yeah? There's something more there. And this again was used to establish things like how karma can go from one life to the next one. So this was the pugala. The pugala was neither identical or the five tantras were different. It was this kind of very philosophical kind of idea. And they were heavily criticized again, very heavily criticized for trying to sneak a soul, to sneak a permanent essence into the back door of Buddhism. So pugala, they think they have different meanings depending on the context. It was a Pugalavada school, and it died out very quite early on in Buddhism. We don't know much about it. There's a few texts still available now, and translated into Chinese. So you can read about the Pugalavada in Chinese if you wish. At least a little bit, but not that much. But we know about them because they are written about in the Theravada sources. Theravadins are arguing with the Pugalavadins, yeah? Javan will call the Katavattu. Katavattu, the basis of discussion or something like that, where we have all the discussion between the different schools of Buddhism. I wouldn't really recommend it at all unless you are really keen on this kind of stuff. But it's there anyway, part of the Abhidhamma Pitaka. Last question for today. Dear Ajahn, the Buddha sent the 8 Garudamas for bhikkhuni ordination. First Garudama, none who has been ordained even for 100 years, must greet respectfully, rise up from the seat, salute with joint palms, do proper homage to the monks who ordained that day. Is there any reason for this Garudama? Is there any reason for it? I guess, do you mean, is it required, or should we really follow this Garudama? Maybe that's what you mean. And the reason, interesting, where does it come from, yeah? Did the Buddha actually lay down these Garudamas? Are they later kept in the camp after the Buddha? And all of these things are very controversial, and it's difficult to come to any final decision when they actually arose. But it has a little bit the width of Indian society about them. Yes, Indian society was very stratified and was very discriminatory, I think, against women, particularly in the society. Women were considered quite low in the hierarchy. In many ways, the Buddha kind of raised the position of women up by allowing them to be different and almost work on the same footing as the monks. So the question about the Garudama is a difficult one. But one of the most important things about the Garudama is, if you disregard how they were established, whether they were established by the Buddha or not, it's very difficult to say. What they are, one thing we know about the Garudama is that they are just minor rules. When you hear the word Garudama, Gar literally means heavy or important. Dhamma means rule. So
So it sounds like it is an important rule, yeah? It sounds like it's very heavy, right? But when you actually look at the rule, there is no penalty for breaking them, yeah? So because there is no penalty for breaking them, the rules are always categorized according to the penalty. Actually, what they are just really symptoms of Indian society. They are like conduct that was expected at that time. Yeah, that's what they really are. There is no penalty for breaking them. Right? And many of the other rules that we have in the Patibhanga, if you break the rules, but you have a good reason for doing so, it's usually okay. So I would say that this particular rule, in my opinion, there is absolutely no reason why the monks have to keep this rule. Because I think that even if the Buddha did lay it down, it was a rule that was applicable to that society at that time. And it wasn't really a rule, an important rule that should be followed by bhikkhus outside of that context. That is my understanding of that. So many bhikkhus still choose to follow the Gardama. It's up to them. I'm not going to tell them what to do. But if a bhikkhuni tells me that, you know, I don't practice this particular Gardama, then I don't have any problem with that at all, personally. In any case, it's for the bhikkhunis to decide what they want to do, yeah? It's not for me to tell them. Bhikkhunis are a separate sangha. The monks are a separate sangha, and it's up to the bhikkhunis to choose how they want to live their lives. It's not for the monks to tell them that. That's my understanding of this, and I guarantee you that there will be people who disagree, but anyway, that's my understanding of that. So, there you are. That was the last question in the box. Does anyone want to ask anything more before we go? Or are you exhausted now? Your mind is turned to mush and you can't kind of think clearly anymore now? Everybody happy now? Yeah, anyone not happy now? Anyone miserable? Everybody okay? Okay, so for those of you who are leaving, bye-bye. So we'll see you again. Hopefully, soon. Maybe I will come back next week. Who knows? I'm certain. Don't guarantee for these things. For those of you who are living, very nice to have you here. One of the great things about the Dhamma, what I like to see, is always to see people coming back again year after year. Because I know that when people come back year after year, they are committed, they are sincere, they are persevering in the practice. And that is the kind of people who will have good results. So keep on doing that, and then you should do very well. So I wish you all well, those of you.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay, anything else for me? Anything fine? Yep. Good. I will get back to now.
Satipanno Bhagavato.